Hello, I'm Llewellyn King, the host of White House Chronicle. But first, a few thoughts of my own. Although my name is King, I am not of the royal persuasion, but from time to time I run into the royal family. Now, immediately, you know I'm talking about the British royal family. Nobody thinks of other royal families, not the one in Thailand or the one in the Netherlands. There are other, or the one for that matter, that hangs out in Belgium. When we say royal, we think England, we think the Queen of England, and we've been thinking royal quite a bit lately because we have a new princess, Princess Charlotte of Cambridge, but also because of the extraordinary figure of the Queen herself, who somehow is the Queen of the world, not just of England. She works so hard, shows up everywhere, diligently goes about her duties in a big hat, which has never caught on, dressed perfectly, but of another time. And we don't even laugh at her anymore, even the English. We used to make jokes about her rather piping voice. Gradually, she's re-established the royal family in the affections of the British public, and for that matter, the affections of the world. After some of the disastrous things in her family, she herself described 1992 as her horrible year. I'm not going to repeat it on television because people get it wrong. Somehow she's gathered it all together, and suddenly the monarch is very popular again. The monarchy is very popular, and the monarch herself is very popular. It's quite an extraordinary achievement. What does it do for Britain? Well, it's an emotional peg to hang on the baggage which goes with being head of state as opposed to head of government, something, a luxury we don't enjoy in the United States. But for the moment, the royal family is ensconced. Who knows what will happen as things progress? And it's particularly well-seated at the moment because of an 89-year-old woman, Elizabeth Windsor, who works all the time in her hat with her gloves at being the Queen of England. It's quite an act, and she pulls it off magnificently. We're going to have a discussion today of another matter that was pulled off magnificently, but rather more serious. The raid in 1942 on Tokyo by very brave American pilots led by the famous Doolittle. To question the author of a new book on that is my colleague and friend from the Pell Center, Robert Whitcomb, and the author, and I must say that I'm in enormous admiration of the scholarship that goes into producing a book like this, is James M. Scott. James, welcome to the broadcast. What are the salient points in the Doolittle raid?
You know, for folks who may not be familiar with this story, it's essentially a story of America in its darkest hour. The Japanese had attacked us at Pearl Harbor, had destroyed much of our Pacific fleet, and President Roosevelt recognized that the American public needed a morale booster, that they needed something to, a symbolic act, if you will, to convince the American people that in the end we would win, we would pull through and we would survive. And so he pressed his military commanders to come up with a way to strike back at the Japanese. And he didn't want just attack on a far-flung island in the Japanese Empire, but he wanted to strike directly on Tokyo. And so the Doolittle Raid, and it's named for Lieutenant Commander Jimmy Doolittle, who led it, was a result of that. And it took place on April 18, 1942, and it was an incredibly audacious raid in which we flew 16 Army bombers with 80 volunteer airmen on a one-way mission off an American aircraft carrier to attack Japan and then fly and escape to free China. So it's one of the, I think, one of the most incredible stories of World War II.
James, why were the Japanese taken so surprised by this?
You know, up until this point, you know, it's easy for us to remember Pearl Harbor, but the Japanese had actually, their conquest didn't stop just there. They attacked us at Pearl Harbor. They took Guam from us, Wake Island. The Philippines was under siege and would soon fall. They took Hong Kong and Singapore from the British. Dutch East Indies, what we now know as Indonesia, from the Netherlands.
Tons of oil,
exactly. Right. I mean, yeah. they'd even made raids on northern Australia. And so in a very short time period, they extended their empire over 20 million square miles, seven time zones. It's an incredible feat accomplished really in a few months. And so the Japanese public was really under the impression, from what they were being told by their leaders, that they were invincible. And their own media was referring to their airmen and Marines and sailors as gods. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly one day on April 18th at noon, 16 American Army bombers appear in the skies over Tokyo. At noon, shortly thereafter, but lunchtime.
But in daylight,
where absolutely.
Where they could be seen. Maximum impact.
Absolutely.
And the anti-aircraft people weren't able to do anything.
Yeah, exactly. Japan had spent so much of its resources actually on frontline positions elsewhere, fighting
expansion
and whatnot, that they had not left.
Push forward. Yeah.
Exactly. They had not left the resources, their sort of first-line fighter pilots and defense forces at home. Mm. And they also really suffered from a lot of complacency. I mean, they had so many great successes that they really didn't think, hey, the Americans, they could pull something like this off.
Who was the genius who thought this up and said, this can be done? We can reduce the distance from the aircraft carrier to Tokyo to 500 miles. Mm-hmm. In the end, it was
their pushback 650. From the American administration with this crazy plan.
Yeah, no, actually, I mean, this plan actually started with the American administration. It started with Roosevelt himself. I mean, before all the bodies were pulled out of the waters in Pearl Harbor, he demanded of his top military aides to find a way to strike back. Now, we didn't have any bases from which to operate because they had all been taken. And we were we didn't want to take our aircraft carriers in so close to Japan using naval planes because the distances that they could fly single-engine aircraft were too short. And we would have exposed the few aircraft carriers we had.
That would have just been fighter planes.
Yeah, exactly. Right? And we would have risked our aircraft carriers. It actually, the plan for it started with a Navy submariner who was down at Norfolk and saw naval pilots practicing takeoffs on a runway that was marked up to look like a flight deck. And he thought, what if we took, instead of Navy planes, what if we took a medium Army bomber twin engine that would have much greater distance and made it so that it could take off? And that was the genesis. And at that point, it became a challenge of logistics.
What was the restricting, taking off from the ship for which they, what was the restriction? Weight? Because it was carrying bombs plus extra fuel?
Yeah, it's size, actually. They had to find a bomber that could clear the that could take off in a short amount of space, but also that its wings weren't so large that it could clear the aircraft carrier island, the superstructure. And the B-25 is what they decided because it from the wingtip to the island had 7 feet of clearance.
One of the intriguing things was the use of broomsticks to simulate guns in the tail where there were no guns.
Absolutely. Well, to make it work, they had to strip the bombers of everything unnecessary, including radios, the lower rear gun turret. But to scare off any potential fighters that might come up behind, they developed this ruse of basically putting two wooden sticks that looked like broomsticks painted black out of the tail. So if you were flying up behind it, it would actually look like that there was a 50 caliber machine gun.
Now, how low were they flying over Tokyo?
They came in at rooftop level. And then when they bombed, pulled up to about 1,500 feet, dropped their bombs, and dropped back down.
Yeah. Now, astonishing.
It's amazing.
They carried 2,000 pounds of bombs. Yeah. Three high explosive and one incendiary.
Yeah.
They weren't very effective, were they, except in terms of the psychology there and the psychology here.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, you have to remember this raid, Tokyo spread out over 200 square miles.
We have some pictures we'll put on the screen of the devastation, which was not enormous.
No, not at all.
Compared with what we came to expect from bombing in World War II.
Certainly, yeah. Tokyo spread out over 200 square miles. It's a huge city. You're using just 16 planes with four bombs each. I mean, it can hardly dent Japan's powerful war machine, particularly when you compare it to the end of the war when we were sending 500 bombers a night.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was about psychology, and it was about showing the Japanese people that the line that they were being told by their government, their military leaders, that Japan was invincible, that it wasn't true. And and it was about sort of creating that division between the people and the Japanese.
Maybe a little like the British bombing of Berlin in 1941. I think it was,
Yeah, I mean, we didn't have the resources to follow up and to repeatedly do this, but it was the one-time operation that we were after.
We still hadn't made enough planes to...
So what was the reaction in Japan?
A lot of astonishment. The Japanese leaders were outraged. They were humiliated. In fact, they captured some of the raiders in China, and most of them wanted to have those raiders executed. I think the Japanese public, when it actually happened, thought it was a drill at first. And many of them actually went out in the streets to watch. But slowly over time, as they realized what had happened, there was a real sense of shock. I mean, it had a huge psychological effect, not only on the leaders, but on the average everyday citizens.
Was that something they thought might happen a year later, perhaps, if the war went on? Was the rapidity with which it happened?
Yeah, and in fact,
you're talking about April 42, Pearl Harbor, December 41. That's pretty fast.
Oh yeah, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, it's really just it's less than 5 months between the two, which is astonishing considering that this operation they had to modify these bombers, train these pilots in how to take off from an aircraft carrier, and assemble a task force of 16 warships and 10,000 men. From a logistics standpoint, that's pretty amazing to accomplish that.
Just to pull it together.
Pull it together in just about 16 weeks.
Tell me about the crews. What happened to the crews?
Yeah, and that's actually one of the most exciting stories is, from the moment they took off, every crew had its own unique story. One of the crews was incredibly low on fuel, and they diverted to Russia, where they were interned for 13 months. The rest flew on to China. Now, it's important to remember these pilots all had to take off over 800 miles away from Tokyo. And Doolittle had set 650 miles as the outside limit from where they could take off, bomb Japan, and still expect to make it to China without having enough fuel. So the moment they took off, these airmen thought, we're never going to make it. At that point, it was essentially a suicide mission. And yet they were aided by, as one of them said, the hand of heaven. A tailwind that blew them that distance from Japan to China. But they all came in low on fumes, out of fuel, and in foul weather. And the runways they were looking for, the radio beacons weren't on. They'd arrived early. So they all either had to bail out or crash land. And from then, they had to make their way overland with the Japanese army chasing after them. So
I mean, it's Japanese-occupied territory.
Exactly. They came to Japanese-occupied Manchuria at that point in a number of key coastal areas. And we're on the hunt at that point to try and capture these raiders.
And did we lose any of the raiders, or did they all make it?
We did. We lost three, died during bailout. Eight of them were captured. Of those that were captured, three were executed. One starved to death in prison, and the other four suffered 40 horrific months in Japan's notorious POW.
Executed as war criminals?
Yeah, they were. They were executed by firing squad. Japan actually held a sort of a sham trial lasted about 30 minutes. These men weren't given any representation. They were convicted and then shortly thereafter executed.
What kind of immediate change was there in Japanese strategy as a result?
Well, I think the biggest thing is at that point, the Doolittle Raid occurred at a pretty key time in Japan's military planning. They had accomplished their initial goals with Pearl Harbor and the acquisition of territory. But Yamamoto, who was the architect of the attack on Pearl Harbor, Admiral Yamamoto, the son of a samurai warrior, was very upset that the American aircraft carriers had been absent that day at Pearl Harbor. And he knew because of the various raids we'd had in sort of outer parts of the Japanese Empire that these aircraft carriers were going to come back and haunt Japan. It was a game of Russian roulette. At some point, those carriers were going to show up off Tokyo. And he knew that the only way to get the Americans to bring those carriers to battle was to go after a piece of real estate that was so priceless, we'd have no option but to engage. Because up until that point, we'd treated our carriers like endangered species. He knew he could never get the Japanese army to greenlight another attack on Hawaii, so he picked Midway. And he encountered incredible pushback from the not only from the army, but also from others in the Navy, until Jimmy Doolittle showed up in the skies over Tokyo. Doolittle was his salesman.
What was the reaction among the American public? This was the first good news out of the war, in a way.
It was huge. I mean, it was a potent tonic to really to assure that it had the exact effect Roosevelt wanted. It was all over the front pages. It was on the radio. This was the type of morale booster that Roosevelt needed.
Build more support in Congress.
Absolutely. And you have to remember at this point, when we started the war in 41, Roosevelt knew that we were in no position to go on the offensive, that it would take much of 1942, in fact, to enlist and train new troops, build ships, build planes, rifles, bullets. And he needed a diversion, something that while we did that work, while we built all of that and trained those folks, that could make it appear that, we were still fighting. We were being on the offensive. And the Doolittle Raid helped accomplish that.
We're going to take a little moment for station identification. This is for the benefit of our listeners on Sirius XM Radio, Channel 124, the POTUS channel. You are listening to White House Chronicle with myself, Llewellyn King, Bob Whitcomb of the Pell Center, and our honored guest today, James Scott, who has written this rattling good story about the Jimmy Doolittle raid on Tokyo in 1942, one of the great achievements in American heroics, very brave people doing something almost impossible to do and pulling it off. You can also see this program on the English language stations of the Voice of America and on select PBS and PEG stations in the US and some commercial stations, 200 screens altogether. Back to what happened to Jimmy Doolittle. What was the rest of his life like?
Well, Doolittle, because all the planes crashed and the folks had to bail out, he was convinced the mission was a total failure. In fact, he was convinced he was going to be court-martialed, and yet he returned home to receive the Medal of Honor in May of 1942, and so because of the huge effect that it had. Doolittle, he was promoted at that point to Brigadier General, and he went on to fight in the European theater and then come back to come back over to the Pacific theater near the war's end. So.
As a pilot, he remained a pilot?
No, as a commander.
Yep. As a commander. Mm-hmm. Were you able to interview any of these men?
I was. You know, there were 80 volunteer airmen, two of whom are still surviving today, including Jimmy Doolittle's co-pilot, who's 99-year-old Dick Cole. He lives in Texas, and also 93-year-old Dave Thatcher, who lives in Montana. And for folks who may have seen 30 Seconds Over Tokyo or read the book, he's the young enlisted man who saves the lives of Ted Lawson and the other members after they crash land off an island in China. So those two are the last two surviving Doolittle Raiders. When I started working on the book, there were a few others whom I talked to and interviewed as well.
So. What was the, speaking of China, what was the effect in China of this that led to severe reprisals by the Japanese, right?
Absolutely, and that's a part of the story that until now has not gotten enough attention. The Japanese, of course, were furious over the Doolittle Raid. And they set out, they realized that the United States was attempting to use these airfields in coastal China. And so they set out with their army to make sure that those airfields could never be used. And also to punish the locals who had helped Doolittle and his men. So they launched a three-month retaliatory campaign that ultimately claimed the lives of 250,000 Chinese men, women, and children. And it prompted comparisons to the Rape of Nanking. I mean, these were brutal atrocities.
They went and destroyed towns, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Just destroyed rape.
Oh, yeah. They
pillaged.
Mass rapes. Yeah. They cut the noses and ears off of villagers. They threw families in wells. Yeah. They even unleashed bacteriological warfare in the form of anthrax, plague, cholera on these areas. And that's, you know, it's interesting that, like, as I noted, that's a part of the story that hasn't really been covered. But when I was doing my research, I managed to find these long-forgotten missionary records in the archives of DePaul University. And see, the U.S. didn't have any boots on the ground in that part of China at the time, and so we had no one to witness this. But there were a lot of American missionaries there who were on the front lines of this slaughter. And they wrote letters, they took photographs, you know, diary entries, things like that. I even found their property insurance damage claims that they filed with their insurers for the loss of their parishes.
I mean, the loss of their parishes to the Japanese.
To the Japanese, because the Japanese would come in and destroy them.
What became of the missionaries? Did not.
Well, what happened is the missionaries, when the Japanese came, and some of these missionaries helped Doolittle and his raiders, they fled. They went into the woods. They went up into the mountains and whatnot, and they waited till the Japanese had sort of moved through. And then they would come back in, they would see the damage, and then they would write letters to other missionaries farther down and say, this is what happened here. Be prepared.
Right.
And so those letters survived. Those photographs survived. And they really, for the first time, give us an up-close and personal view of just how horrible this retaliation by the Japanese was against the Chinese.
There was a lot of brutality in Asia in the 30s,
certainly,
into the 40s. How has that colored our relationships, or the relationships, say, between Japan and China today, or today's arguments about the East China Sea, for example?
Well, I think that's the undercurrent of all of it. If you scratch beneath the veneer, that's what's at play here. I mean, you have to remember. The war between Japan and China and the violence there, I mean, it's still just beneath the surface. Mm-hmm. They remember that. In fact, I was actually talking to, I was at one of the Doolittle reunions just a few weeks ago, and I was talking to a Chinese journalist who had been over there, and they're still anthrax survivors from this specific
from
retaliation.
From the experiments.
Exactly, yeah. From which that they had gone in to interview. And so, you know, there's a lot of that tension is still there, and I think that's kind of it, what we're seeing at play today in contemporary relations.
And still duking it out about those little islands.
Yeah, I think that's just sort of the pretext to these much deeper tensions that still run.
Including some new islands, brand
new. Islands, yeah, that they're
right.
Pouring concrete on, making even more islands.
That's in the South China Sea, not the
East
China Sea. The Abe, the Japanese Prime Minister, has been in America apologizing, or sort of apologizing. Yeah. And apologies are a big deal in Asia.
Certainly.
There's a lot goes into these apologies or not apologies, or whether the apology is sincere, if it's complete enough, if there's enough sense that it is heartfelt. What's the general measure of the apology on the apology meter these days?
It's pretty weak, I think. If you look at Germany, who has had a history of atonement, very public atonement for what happened in World War II, you don't see that out of Japan these days. Japan has an official apology from the 1995, but you know, Abe has been under pressure from his folks in his own government to sort of walk back, to sort of disavow Japan's wartime legacy, and it's creating a lot of tension.
Rebuild its military.
Exactly, and, right. And it's creating tension not just with the Chinese, with the Koreans over the issue of comfort women as well. So I think, that there's a lot of resentment that's still out there with Japan and its neighbors.
What'd you make of the Japanese Prime Minister's remarks to Congress?
I thought that they were okay. I think he's got, a lot of the focus is going to be more on marking the his comments that are going to come this August, when he is to mark the official end to World War II. And I think that's kind of where a lot of people's eyes are really looking at now, sort of where, what's he going to say at that point?
You have written other books. How many?
This is my third book. I wrote another book, The War Below, which is about the submarine war in the Pacific. And prior to that, I wrote The Attack on the Liberty, which was about a Israeli attack on a U.S. spy ship in the 1960s.
What is it that draws you to military themes?
I was a military reporter for the Post and Courier newspaper in Charleston, and so
it's a big military town.
Big military state. I was covering the military at that point, and my father was actually on the Liberty, which was the subject of my first book. And so while I was covering the military, I was talking to Dad over Thanksgiving and Christmas. And saying,
it was in the Eastern Mediterranean.
It was, It was right off the Gaza Strip, and saying and asking him, saying, Dad, you were involved in this crazy incident in 1967. Tell me about it. And that grew into a series of oral histories. And from that, ultimately, came my first book. And from there, it just sort of one thing led to another, and now I'm three books out, and a fourth one due in February.
How many pages? This is 487 pages without this extensive, maybe 100 pages of notes?
Yeah, it's 672 pages total.
That is a lot of work.
It's a triumph of masochism.
How did you decide on Doolittle?
I think it's one of the greatest stories of World War II. You know, on the one hand, it's a story of a mission. It's a story of one raid, lasts a few hours, 80 men. But it's a much bigger story than just that. It has all the symbolism and the power.
The timing.
I mean,
and Doolittle was such a brilliant guy.
He really was. Yeah. And we haven't touched on what an amazing figure he
really
was.
Really a scientist as well as a military man.
He's the first pilot to have ever flown cross-country in less than a day.
Yeah.
He helped develop the artificial horizon, which is standard on planes today. He's the first pilot to ever fly on instruments alone.
A degree from MIT.
Exactly. Doctorate from MIT. Yeah. I mean, he's really...
The artificial horizon is absolutely essential.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It shows you in straight and level or otherwise...
I'm a private pilot.
I don't know how people fight in airplanes. I've always found it hard enough to be safe in peace with a lot of help on the ground from air traffic controllers, etc., let alone fight or go out with those primitive instruments.
Yeah, with somebody behind you and in front of you.
And a sextant to look at the skies to see where you were. Yeah. Extraordinary.
Absolutely.
What is your next book about?
Doing a book now on the Battle for Manila, February 1945, which was the bloodiest urban fight of the Pacific War, led to about 100,000 civilian deaths.
And not many Americans know anything about it.
I mean, there's been hardly anything done on it.
Is it not a fact? It seems to me that, there's this big industry of writing about the war, and there are channels on television dedicated to the Second World War, essentially. And yet... the preponderance of all of that is Europe,
I agree completely.
Not Asia.
Yeah.
You don't see television shows about the fighting in Asia. You hear references to Midway, etc., Guadalcanal, but not the way we go through each step of the beaches of Normandy, for example.
Exactly.
Why is that?
You know, I think, I mean, there are really only a handful of writers, I think, working professionally full-time on what happened in the Pacific. I think the United States has always been more culturally aligned with Europe.
And I think that kind of... It is a spawn of Europe.
Certainly.
Is,
and I think
is
that's
there a language barrier, too?
Well, there's a language barrier with German, I think, as well. I mean,
but
if you're
it's easy to get German translated accurately.
Could be.
A lot harder, probably, to get Japanese and Chinese, where there's vagueness in the language to begin with.
Certainly. Yeah, it could certainly be that. And I'm fortunate that I spent a year teaching in Japan right out of college, still have contacts over there, and was able to, you know, use those resources to help me out with my research.
What were you teaching? Excuse me.
I was a public school teacher.
Really? Yeah,
I taught junior high school English.
In the city?
No, I taught out in a very rural area. Yeah. So it was sort of started me down this track.
Can you read Japanese?
No, I cannot. No.
You cannot. Can you speak a bit of it?
Not much. Even after a year there, it was...
It's very difficult.
Yeah.
What were the biggest military lessons of the Doolittle Raid for the United States and everyone else?
Well, I think really the biggest lessons came for the Japanese. I think it's sparking of the Battle of Midway and the disaster that happened there was really the biggest thing to have come of it. You know, the United States, it was such a fast-moving war that we very quickly, around this time was the Battle of the Coral Sea, then the Battle of Midway, then Guadalcanal, that it moved very quickly. Mm-hmm. So the lessons that we could have learned and applied, I think the war just took on its own pace. So, I mean, originally they talked about maybe doing a follow-up type raid similar to that. Hap Arnold, who was the commander of the Air Force, asked his staff to look at possibilities.
But much bigger.
Well, not even, it probably wouldn't have been a whole lot bigger, but nothing ever came of it because the war was so fast moving. So,
what about equipment?
You know, even then, throughout the rest of the war, flew Army bombers in a combat situation off of an aircraft carrier. So it didn't really, it didn't have a huge effect there either.
It's really a kind of one-off.
It really was. Yeah. It absolutely was. Yeah.
Makes it more fascinating.
Yeah.
Let me ask this differently. How has study of the Japanese in the Second World War affected your attitude to Japan today?
You know, I've got, I think I'm lucky in that I worked in Japan for a while, so I have firsthand knowledge of Japanese people and still have friends over there. I think that that's been very helpful to me in my research and my understanding. I think that one of the interesting elements of looking at Japan that during World War II is just to see there were a lot of very brilliant leaders. There was also a lot of barbarism and a lot of really awful things that happened. You know, I think it doesn't really affect me on a day-to-day basis what I think of the Japanese now, but I definitely think it helps my history and understanding and having been over there.
Did you ever get into any discussions about the role of the emperor? The word, it looks worse than it used to when I was growing up.
We have just a few seconds.
I think one of the interesting elements of the emperor was the role he played in the possibility of the execution of some of the Doolittle Raiders. That was sort of the one role he did play, and sort of intervening to prevent them from executing all eight of them.
That is our show for today. I thank Robert Whitcomb and, of course, James Scott, the author of this magnificent volume. Go out and buy it. It's highly readable. We will see you next week on the same stations at the same time and on the radio. Until then, all the very best. Cheers.